What two terrific readings we just had, everybody. Do we need a sermon after those readings? They speak for themselves in a most remarkable way. Though perhaps the Daniel passage needs a bit more explanation in some measure, but our sermon today looks back a little bit, at least, to the Daniel passage. So good morning, everybody. It's very good to have those two readings from Ken Edwards. And then, of course, this second one read just now by my dear wife, Pam. And that's Mark's Gospel in chapter 13. That's where we're going to be staying for the next few minutes. Just before the service, I had a word with our vicar, Stephen. And he said that he'd been preaching on my passage earlier this morning at 8 o'clock. And I said to him, oh, I wish you could be preaching this passage now then, because I think you'd do it much better than I would. When she told me the content of his sermon, I thought, oh my. Actually, we're looking forward next Sunday to a visiting preacher. I think we heard a bit about it earlier. Edmund Chan of Singapore. He's a most captivating preacher with a church of many thousands in his church. And also he has the opportunity to convene vast numbers of Asian leaders all around Southeast Asia in great conventions. And we should look forward very much to seeing what he's going to bring to us on Palm Sunday. Bring your friends. I think we will all enjoy Edmund Chan. So here we are. The topic I've been asked to address is entitled The Storm Before the Calm. So we're looking at these words spoken by Jesus Christ on coming out of the temple at Jerusalem, a fantastic building created by Herod, the puppet Jewish king placed in charge of the people of Judea by the Roman Caesars. Reconstructions that people have tried to draw of that temple resemble a superb birthday cake on white marble, settled firmly on a massive platform of rock the top of Mount Moriah. Isn't it beautiful? Cried the disciples of Jesus that day. Verse 1. Look at those wonderful stones, they said. But Jesus didn't seem particularly impressed. It's all going, he announced. The whole pile is going to dust. His friends looked again and they could hardly take it in. Inevitably, the question suggested itself. Verse 4. Well, first of all, when? And then further, verse 4, what will be the sign of these future events? Slowly, they began to realize that Jesus, as he foretold the impending destruction of the temple by the Romans, was symbolically linking Jerusalem's approaching catastrophe to the event that precede the end of the world itself. When he said there in verse 30, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Actually, sometimes people ask about that. Did they think that Jesus was mistaken? That the people that he was speaking to then would still be alive when he came back? That's not the answer. The answer is that Jesus was talking about Jerusalem and its sacking in AD 70, and that was going to be the kickoff for the whole of what was going to follow on later, the end times. So he is saying, there will be people here now, and you won't die, because you'll see the start of the whole thing. He said very much the same thing in Luke's Gospel, when he said, there will be those standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God coming in great power. Was he mistaken? No. Because only a few paragraphs later on, we read about the transfiguration, which was a preview of the glorious kingdom at the end of the age. That is what he was referring to. So let's ask ourselves this morning, do we believe the Bible and the creed that we were uttering at the beginning of the service, that speak of the end of the age, when Christ will return visibly, bodily, universally? Theologians and Bible students speak of those end times in terms of what they call, technical word is, eschatology, from the Greek word eschatos, trespass, meaning last. Those early believers were ready for the last days, for the coming of Christ again at any time. Indeed, they'd even be spared death if the return of Jesus came first. Well, that could be your situation and mine too. On an occasion when there had been a bereavement in our own family, and I reminded the family of such a possibility, and I said, perhaps I needn't bother to make plans for my own death. Maybe I can bank on the real possibility that Christ's return, what the Bible experts call the eschaton, will happen in my own lifetime. And I won't have to die at all. My daughter Wendy chipped in and she said, well, Dad, for you it would be just lovely if the eschaton was to happen first. But wouldn't it be wise, do you think, for us to have a plan B? Well, this chapter of Mark 13 spells out in some detail with the challenges and even turmoils that the believer can expect to face. Indeed, Christ could return today. But his faithful followers are called on to plan, work, pray, and have their lives in order in the light of that coming day. So it is that here in verse 5, Jesus sternly tells his listeners, watch out that no one deceives you. Look at the passage with me. Like the prophets of old, Jesus was using the coming historical events involving the destruction of Jerusalem in a remarkable telescoping of history. And in this way, the immediately approaching crisis was to be a preview, a kind of local rehearsal of the final and universal crisis that would one day affect the whole world. The teaching in the Bible about the last days on earth has been, well, it's been derided again and again. But there have always been those who fully discern something of the end times, and they live according to it. Years ago, Arabella Churchill, granddaughter of Sir Winston Churchill, said, my grandfather used the phrase the Iron Curtain. It seems to be that what is facing us all now is the final curtain. That actually is right. That's the next item. So that does express what people do feel at certain crisis points in human history, when even the most solid of institutions begin to shake and crumble. And at those moments, the thought breaks out and surfaces in books, sermons, films, discussions. Maybe the end is upon us. Watch out, said Jesus to his friends in verse 5. Watch out that no one deceives you. In fact, the Lord was never to enter that temple again. It had been his last visit. In this way, our chapter 13 of Mark presents us with one of the classic Bible passages on the events that will precede the end of the world. What's utterly fascinating is the way in which the destruction of Jerusalem, which actually did take place in AD 70, only a few years later, and the end of the world, these two events are run together in parallel in the teaching of Jesus. So verse 14 brings the destruction of Jerusalem and of its temple firmly into the picture language relating to the end times. And in that terrible destruction of AD 70, the Roman armies, with its idolatrous images and their banners, they brought about the desecration of the city and of the revered holy place of the temple. And indeed, this catastrophic event had been preceded many, many years earlier. It would be a repeat of the dreadful atrocity that had featured back in the 2nd century BC. And it was then that the pagan Syrian Greek dictator Antiochus Epiphanes, that was his name, he placed a pagan altar in Jerusalem's temple. So when looking on at verse 14, where Jesus speaks of the abomination that causes desolation, They were standing where it should not. Mark's gospel adds, let the reader understand. Oh, they would understand. They would. Many of Jesus' hearers would nod knowingly, because no Jew ever forgot the terrible persecutions that Antiochus had committed against the Jewish people in those earlier days. So Jesus was emphasizing that there was going to come to Jerusalem a repeat act of sacrilege. It was all going to happen again. And this destruction was to be a symptom of what disciples of Christ can expect before the final end, when evil will be intensified and even personified in a person or persons known under that title that had earlier identified Antiochus Epiphanes, namely the abomination that causes desolation. Watch out was the warning. So here was the warning first. Yes, verse 5, the warning that no one deceives you. It's no accident that in countries where Christ's teaching has been made known, there's always inevitably an interest in history. Any nation that has a lot of Christianity in it believes in a straight line of history culminating in Jesus' return. Of course, it's the goal of history, centering in Christ, that gives lasting relevance to events and movements. And the goal is that he will come again to judge the living and the dead, as we said earlier in our creed. And his kingdom will have no end. It was the 4th century Latin poet Prudentius who pays tribute in one of his poems to the ability of Christ to bring everything together. He explains that during the mighty growth of the Roman Empire, I quote, Christ even then was coming, and the way was being made ready for him. Friends, history is not circular, as some of the traditional Eastern beliefs maintain. There will be no succession of reincarnations. As the Bible tells us in Hebrews 9, verse 27, it is appointed unto man once to die, and after that, the judgment. There's an end coming, and Christ has given us all the information we need in himself. He is the goal of all history, the only Messiah that the world could ever look for. And so he gives his warning, watch out that no one deceives you. Indeed, in verse 6, he warns us against deceiving messengers who will claim, I'm the one, come to me. There are indeed going to be some false Christs, even in the days immediately following the Lord's resurrection. But these impostors would evidently be a feature of the last days as well, and there are plenty of them. And when are the last days? Basically, the last days refer to our present Christian era, the period between Christ's first coming and his second coming at the close of the age. The next significant item on God's agenda is his son's return, when his triumphant kingdom will be gathered in forever. We are in the last days now, sisters and brothers. We can certainly recognize a multiplicity of false Christs and messiahs who have presented themselves across the centuries. And John, in his letters, refers to antichrists as in 1 John 2 and verse 18, where he refers to one or more claimants, to messiahship. People who put themselves in the place of Christ in opposition to his rule. And the main characteristic of their teaching centers around their false view of the person of Jesus. So 1 John 4 verse 3 puts it clearly, every spirit which does not confess Jesus is not of God. This is the spirit of Antichrist. My wife Pam's former vicar, Guy King in Beckenham, Kent, he put it strongly in one of his books. Some, he said, when he talked about Christ, some deny Christ's deity, some deny his miracles, some deny his virgin birth, some deny his word, some deny his atoning death, Some deny his bodily resurrection. Some deny his personal return. Antichrists, the lot of them. Well, the Bible also states that near the very end can be anticipated the raising of a final personification of evil and opposition, of whom we read in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 3, and elsewhere, Book of Revelation. Oh, the premature conclusions that people have jumped to as to who that abomination of desolation, who that Antichrist is. Umpteen dictators have been thought of as the final Antichrist. But rather than engage in guesswork, we can best recognize any form of Antichrist by focusing our thoughts, our reading, our worship on the real Christ. Then when we recognize and see him as he really is, we can more easily identify the impersonations. Many of these figures in history were the founders of great heresies and deviations of the faith. I'm sure Stephen there and Simon there, I'm sure, like me, I'm sure you had to do with them all at college, those people. Gnosticism, Docetism, Nestorianism, Apollinarianism, Sabellianism, Arianism, plenty more. They all went down in the end. As an American preacher once put it, the lesson of history is that the isms all eventually became wasms. And we can hold to that. Jesus warned his friends, verse 21, at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. Again, verse 23, so be on your guard. I have told you everything ahead of time. We are to watch out then that no one deceives us. But look on now, would you, at verse 9. You are following the Bibles, are you? Suppose. Mark 13, verse 9. We're also warned, watch out and guard yourselves. You must be on your guard, said the Lord. He explains that faithful friends of his will be handed over to opponents, both secular, religious, and political. And yet, verse 10, the gospel must continue to be preached everywhere before the end can come. Many there will be, he said, who will be on trial for their lives, but they'll be given words of truth and courage by the power of the Holy Spirit when facing trial. Oh, the many such, we can think of some of the martyrs who've gone to the Lord over these past years. Pam has a godson in Burundi who's a headmaster of a school. How Burundi has suffered. We hear about it again and again. There was a beloved pastor there. One day he was confronted by the gang who disapproved of his beliefs and said, we are going to kill you. He said, may I say something before I die? They said, say it quickly. So he said, first, he said, I love you. Second, I love my country. Third, I will sing a song to you before I die. And with that, in their mother tongue, he sang all four verses of the hymn that begins, out of my sorrow, bondage and night, Jesus, I come. Jesus, I come. The shots rang out and he was gone. There's one witness present who was able to tell the story later. The pressures, they can be immense. With betrayals, Jesus said, taking place even within families and among close ones. But then there's a further area in our passage where we are told to watch out for the signs. So back in verse 4, Peter, James, John and Andrew had already asked Jesus, tell us when will these things happen and what will the sign be that they are all about to be fulfilled? The Lord spells it out, that there'll be hazards in the international realm. He speaks not only of false teachers, but of wars and rumors of wars. When, verse 8, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. Indeed, even in those earliest days of the gospel, such conflicts were already occurring. But in the telescoping of history, such wars will be an ongoing sign that God's people must take heed and be ready for the end. Then there would be hazards of nature too. Again, in those earliest days, there was a spate of natural convulsions, including earthquakes and famines, verse 8. And today, as we see such natural disruptions taking place with weather, land, water, we're right to take our stand in helping victims of such occurrences, while at the same time seeing those occurrences as warning signs to the fact that this earth is not going to endure forever as it is. An end is on its way. But let's be careful about these signs. They're not necessarily there to tell us the immediate imminence of the end. They're not like the sign on the motorway that says, end of motorway, 1 mile. No. They're more like the warning hazard lights on a motorway that will warn of steep gradients or bends in the road that lie ahead, hazards that may be there. You know, it's so easy to get it wrong. Many books have been written that get it completely wrong. Even in the great reformer, Martin Luther, as he studied the book of Daniel, he informed his readers that within a few months, Christ was to come in glory and bring history to an end. All things have been fulfilled, he commented. And that was written back in the year 1530. When I was leading a church in central London, I received a letter from a man who made the following startling proposal. My offer, it read. If the church would most graciously pay my tax after my allowances, then I am willing to let them know of the year of the second coming. The writer was obviously unaware of verse 32, where Jesus declares that, I quote, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Some might ask, why does not even the Son know when the coming will be? Well, it becomes a little bit clearer when we understand that each person of the Trinity bears their own distinctive function. Responsible for salvation's authorization is the Father. Responsible for its action is the Son. Responsible for its application in people's lives is the Spirit. Thus, Jesus, having complete control of his own function as divine executive within the Trinity, he had the capacity to exclude from his consciousness the knowledge of the end day that was the particular prerogative of the Father. I hope that makes a bit of sense. Watch out, Jesus says to us all. We're to watch out that no one leads us astray. We're to watch out for ourselves. We're to watch out for the signs. Last of all, I focus on verse 33, which exhorts us, watch out for your calling. Your calling. In the light of the coming. Your calling. How do we see it? In verse 35, there it is again. Therefore keep watch. And here Jesus compares us to faithful household servants who don't know the precise time when their absent master will return to the house. It's vital, verse 36, that on his return we are not found sleeping. The whole point is that our expectation of Christ's return must have nothing to do with idle curiosity, speculation, or guesswork. The approach of the end time is to make a moral, life-changing impact upon the entire way in which we live. Books and films about, close encounters of the third kind, God as an astronaut, or the Bermuda Triangle, they only tickle the fancy and can become little more than a money-spinning industry. Very few of the devotees to those theories are likely to be found setting up hospitals, helping with relief, or taking Christian education to other countries. We are to be about our business as disciples of Christ and emissaries of his kingdom. On returning from California a few days ago, Pam and I were very moved to hear of the departure from this life of Christchurch member Alan Krause. It was he who, in his later years, he wasn't a young man, when he was inspired, along with beloved Erica there and other dedicated colleagues, to begin the witness of the Good News Cafe here, touching the lives of so many senior citizens of our neighbourhood with projects and programmes, together with a monthly lunch party at which both Pam and I have had the honour of speaking. Alan's passing, it comes as a vivid reminder that we too are to take heed to our calling, whatever our age and aptitudes may be, in the light of that coming day. God bless you and the family today. If we're only content with vague and idle speculation about the future, we actually can't be of very much use in the world's history. The second coming is the next item. That should be enough to comfort the fearful, spur the lazy, and challenge the careless. The day is coming. Do you sometimes feel inclined, oh, I feel like giving up. Oh, the Bible, prayer, church. Oh, I'm tired of waiting for the final close of the age when Christ returns in glory to wrap up history and usher in his final overwhelming reign. No, don't give up. Don't go on any of these things. Prayer, church, Bible, faith, the fellowship, Jesus. Pam and I both know a lady who said to her two little boys many years ago, Maggie Thatcher is about to become Britain's first ever woman Prime Minister. Let's go along to Buckingham Palace. Let's go and see this event as she arrives and then is invited into the palace for the Queen then to ask her to form a government. It's never happened before. His name was called Barbara Townsend. So Barbara took her two little boys along to see this event. And she said to us later that the limo rolled up and Maggie Thatcher got out. People are clapping. Oh, wonderful. Then she went into the palace and people waited for just a little while. And then she came out again. There was the car. Got into the car and off they drove. And Barbara said to her little boys, well, that's it then. Right, let's go off. It's tea time. Then she heard a voice speaking. Don't go. She looked round, bewildered. Who said that? She couldn't see who it was. So she said again, right then, come on, let's go away now. It's time to go. Then she heard it again. Don't go. She looked more carefully this time and saw who it was. One of our London policemen, standing on guard outside the palace, at attention, saying out of the corner of his mouth, don't go. Why, said Barbara, is there something else? Can't tell you, but don't go. Everybody else went. But Barbara, in faithful obedience, stayed. And you know what? She got the best deal that day. She only had to wait 5 minutes, and suddenly the gates of Buckingham Palace opened, and out came the Queen in person. She got easily the best deal. She got royalty that day. So, you see, I think about that day when Christ comes back. Do you feel inclined to give up? Don't go. You want to see the shining finale of the age when Christ, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, comes out of the heavenly palace to usher in his kingdom? Don't go. You want to see the final collapse and taking apart of evil to stand with others over the smoking grave of evil? Don't go. You want to join with patriarchs and prophets, apostles, martyrs? You want to witness the stars falling from heaven, the skies rolling back as Jesus comes back to gather in his own people from the four winds? Then don't go. Don't go. We hold on. We stay on to keep watch, to wait, to work, to worship in daily expectation. The day is coming. He himself has said, I am coming soon. It is the next thing. And it won't be long. It won't be long. Let's close with one of the glorious hymns of the church now.